Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown, I think I left some friends along the way.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden, and the surrounding area. This is Bill Redway, and I'm delighted to be with you again. I'm bringing you the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday, 17th of November. Now, you may remember that I'm keen on folk music, and indeed the folk scene in general, and the music you just heard is by a wonderful young songwriter called Dan Raza, whom I first met a few years ago on a visit to Germany, where we played a number of concerts in Worms, which is St Albans' twin town. He's also played many times in St Albans and was a finalist in the New Roots programme, which is based here and provides opportunities for many young musicians to help them find their feet. The track you'll be hearing during this programme is called Rivertown, from Dan's first CD. You'll be able to hear it in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the Hearts Advertiser, the edition published on the 15th of November, and we follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Sue once again. In part two, we have readings of two articles from Hertfordshire Life magazine about the impact of World War I on Hertfordshire, and part three is an interview by Jill Burridge with Howard Gard, the writer and producer of the video A County at War, Life on the Home Front in Hertfordshire, in recognition of the 100th anniversary of the armistice. We start with the news, and our readers today are Margaret, Hilary, Dominic, and Sarah.
Hello, this is Margaret, and my first piece is about the armistice centenary. A beacon was lit in St Albans over the weekend to mark the end of a day remembering those who fought in World War I. Throughout Remembrance Sunday, events were held in the city to mark 100 years since the armistice. At 6 a.m, as dawn broke, a lone piper stationed outside St Albans Cathedral played The Battle's Oar, a traditional Scottish lament. He was one of 1,000 pipers who played the same tune at historic locations across the country. The two-minute silence took place at 11 a.m. at the city's war memorial beside St Peter's Church, led by Mayor Councillor Rosemary Farmer. There, but not there, Tommy's silhouettes were on display at the Cathedral, the War Memorial and St Albans Museum and Gallery to represent the fallen, and during the evening both the Cathedral and the Museum were illuminated in poppy red. In the evening, hundreds of people lined the pavements to watch and support the annual parade and service, which started in St Peter's Street at 6:30. Representatives from the Royal British Legion, Air, Sea and Army Cadets, HMS Wildfire, the Guiding and Scout Movements and the police all took part in the match. Representatives from the Royal British Legion, Air, Sea and Army Cadets, HMS Wildfire, the Guiding and Scout Movements and the police all took part in the march. After the parade came to a halt by the memorial, there was a multi-faith service with county, district, town and parish councillors attending alongside religious leaders. St Peter's Church Choir led the singing, and pupils from Heathland School for Deaf Children signed "I Vow to Thee My Country." Mayor Rosemary Farmer, accompanied by her mace-bearer, lit the beacon at 7 p.m, one of the thousands that lit up the skies across the country. A further two-minute silence was held to mark the event, and a beacon was also lit at Highfield Park. Afterwards, Mayor Farmer said, "This was an especially poignant Remembrance Day, as it took place on the centenary of the armistice that ended the First World War. I was very proud that once again the whole of our community came together to pay their respects to those who lost their lives while serving their country. I was particularly struck by the huge number of people who found the time and made the effort to turn out for the parade and multi-faith service. It was a magnificent show of support for our armed services. And this piece is accompanied by pictures of people attending the various events throughout the city.
Hi there, it's Hilary here. A MOD bomb squad was called to St Albans last week after builders found a suspected bomb in a dining room. Police and a bomb squad were summoned to Central Drive at 1:48 p.m. on Thursday after the suspicious device was found. Diane Secker said, "We're having an extension built and have builders in. I was away from the house when I had a call from Richard from Abbey Building Services to say the guys on site had discovered something while digging up the dining room floor and had called the police and were awaiting the arrival of the bomb disposal unit. The police who checked it out took it very seriously and they shouted at the flats to close their windows and stay away. They also closed the road between Hazelwood Drive and Woodland Drive. The bomb disposal team x-rayed it and took it away," she added. "It is believed the device was a World War II era bomb, but this is unconfirmed." Diane said a lot of rubble under her house came from the Blitz sites and the building dated back to 1948. According to the bomb site website, several high explosive bombs were dropped on the Jersey Farm area near to Central Drive during World War II. This is not the first time the bomb squad has been called in to handle wartime munitions in St Albans. In 2014, a number of First and Second World War hand grenades, rifles, mortar shells and guns were found at a house on Windmill Avenue. On that occasion, the munitions were detonated by the Ministry of Defence in a farmer's field. Following this, military memorabilia collector Alan Tissington pleaded guilty to 3 charges of possessing ammunition without a certificate and 3 of possessing prohibited ammunition in 2016. Prosecutor John Upton said at Tissington's court hearing, an officer was so concerned at what he saw in the garage that a cordon was set up and 4 neighbouring homes were evacuated for safety. Tissington was given a 12-month community order, instructed to carry out 150 hours of unpaid work and told to pay £1,500 prosecution costs.
Hello, this is Dominic, and the first headline from the story I have for you is: high cost of childcare leaves some parents making a loss if they decide to go to work. St Albans families are being hit by some of the biggest childcare bills in the region. Hertfordshire is the most expensive area in the East of England region for childcare for 3- and 4-year-olds, according to government data. Childcare in St Albans costs an average of £5.75 an hour, according to the Department for Education. 3- and 4-year-olds receive 15 hours free childcare a week and 30 hours for those with parents who both earn 16 hours pay at minimum wage. However, some parents say that what the government provides is not enough to make working equitable. St Albans mum Farida Abdi, a makeup consultant with 2 school-aged children, said, "I earn minimum wage working in retail. By the time I have paid for 2 children to go to after-school club, I have made a loss on my earnings." Ms Abdi explained that it costs £28 a session for both her children to be cared for while she is still at work. Amy Luckhurst of Beaumont Avenue, St Albans, also spends most of her earnings as a nanny on childcare for her 4-year-old son. She claims that the government funding does not apply to her and that she pays £40 per half day. She says, "That is not much less than I earn." Annie Carley, who's 34, of Milford Close, has also found it extremely difficult to juggle working and looking after her child. She said, "I'm a hairdresser. I used to work in a salon before I had my daughter. I now work freelance as I cannot afford the childcare fees. It can be quite isolating working from home, and it is not always practical to have a child around." St Albans mother, Miho Tabara of Pageant Road, is concerned about how she will finance childcare for her baby when she returns to work as a doctor next year. "Childcare for babies is very expensive as there is no help available. Almost my entire wage will be used on childcare for him," she says. Gingerbread, a charity which supports single parents, backed up the claims. Charity director Dahlia Ben-Galim said, Our research shows that some parents spend roughly half their take-home pay on a nursery place, and they consistently tell us that it doesn't always pay to work. She explained that often parents are choosing not to work, as she says it is too risky or doesn't add up.
Hello, I'm Sarah, and I've got an article on wines to be thankful for this season. Independent wine merchant Julia Jenkins offers a fun and informative look at the vintages and varieties of wine. There are many festive occasions to look forward to in the coming months, starting off with American Thanksgiving Day on Thursday, November the 24th. Always held on the fourth Thursday in November, this has been a tradition in the United States since 1863, when during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the celebrating of a national day of Thanksgiving. The first Thanksgiving feast lasted 3 days and provided food for 13 pilgrims and 90 Native Americans, and included fish, shellfish, wildfowl, venison, berries, fruits and vegetables. The classic menu for Thanksgiving in current times includes starters such as butternut squash soup or salad, followed by turkey with a full-flavoured stuffing and gravy, with side dishes including green bean casserole, spicy sprouts, sweet potato bake and macaroni cheese. The favourite desserts are pecan pie and pumpkin bread pudding. Initially, trying to find wines to complement the mélange of flavours in these dishes can seem to be quite challenging, but the key to finding a good food and good wine match is identifying the key ingredient and how it's cooked. To accompany butternut squash soup or other root vegetables such as parsnips and carrots, a rounded and textured white wine is good, such as a New World Chardonnay. This might include Chateau Saint-Michel in Washington State, US, Te Mata in Hawke's Bay, New Zealand, or Rustenburg in Stellenbosch, South Africa, with their lovely mouth-filling textures and tropical flute and vanilla flavours. The main course is full of different flavours, and although turkey's the main element and the strongest flavour, will come from herbs and spices used to flavour the side dishes and sauces, where the cranberry fruits, for example, provide extra flavour dimensions that need to be considered. Often the best solution in such a situation is to start with your favourite style of red or white wine and consider if that or something similar will complement the flavours. If you like claret, this will stand up in strength of flavour but not style because of the obvious tannins, whereas Californian Cabernets, such as that from the Hahn Estates or the Cycles Gladiator Pinot Noir, with its rounder, softer, ripe fruit tones, will be a kinder match. Some of the ripe fruity California Zinfandels with briary damson notes, such as that from the Delicato or Dry Creek, are also worth trying. White wines need to be big wines to match all the main course flavours, so try a Californian Chardonnay such as the Hahn Estates in Monterey or the fabulous mouth-filling Limoux Chardonnay with a rich, soft, ripe fruit. For desserts, the luscious richness of pecan or pumpkin pie can overwhelm a light, elegant, sweet wine, so go for something with enough complexity and richness to match it. This can be found in the Semillon, such as the Dean de Bortelli Vat 5, or its big brother Noble 1 from Australia, the Yalumba Museum Muscat, or the Oloroso Sherry, such as Gonzales Bias Solera, 1847, or the Matusalem Olorose Dolce.
My next piece is entitled Charity Cyclist Condemns Spate of Station Thefts. A charity cyclist has called for more action against train station theft after his bike was stolen. Jason Wills locked up his bike outside St Albans City Station at about 7:30 a.m. on October the 22nd, but by the time he came home from work at about 8 p.m. it was gone. A witness saw someone use bolt cutters to steal the cycle, which is worth £1,000 new. It also has irreplaceable sentimental value. Jason was gifted it for Christmas 3 years ago, and since then has used it to cycle more than 300 kilometres to Paris in aid of JDRF. This is a charity which funds research into type 1 diabetes, an illness Jason's daughter suffers from. Jason reported the theft to employees at St Albans City Station and to British Transport Police, but felt that no one cared. He said, "What was interesting is when I went to inquire with the people at the train station, they said 3 or 4 had been stolen that day, and it's a fairly common occurrence. When I posted about it on Facebook, people said on there it happened all the time, but you never think it will happen to you." It was not covered by Jason's home insurance, and he cannot afford to buy another of the same quality. That bike has been through quite a bit with me in the saddle. I've cycled to Paris and raised money for my daughter's charity, and so much as I can be, I'm emotionally attached to it, he added. If you're trying to encourage people to cycle, they should do more to ensure bikes don't get stolen. A spokesman from British Transport Police said, unfortunately, bicycles remain a popular target for thieves, and we're aware of a number of reports of thefts from St Albans Station in recent weeks. We have a dedicated cycle theft investigation team and would advise cyclists to invest in a good quality D-lock and get their bike securely marked and registered at www.bikeregister.com. Govia Thameslink Rail did not respond to request for comment.
This next article is from the Heart Ads campaign It's Okay to Say, which encourages people of all ages to speak up about mental health concerns before they escalate and obtain the support they need for a healthy and happy life. This week, we hear from St Albans sailor Shona Davis, former competitor in the Clipper Round the World yacht race, about her own struggles with mental health. Being ill sucks. No matter what got you down, the flu, a broken bone, diabetes, cancer, it's a horrible place to be. Your body is weaker and less capable. The drugs you take mess with your mind and your moods and sometimes can make you feel even worse than when you started. Mental ill health is no different. The brain is an organ, and like any organ, it doesn't always function to the medical standard of normal. Mine certainly doesn't. For me, depression hit when I was very young, although no one understood what was going on at the time, least of all me. I remember feelings of isolation, loneliness, and being different. Everyone seemed to be better at everything than I was. Even if other kids invited me to their houses for playdates or told me I was their friend, I didn't believe it. I thought they were just feeling sorry for me and it made me withdraw further. As much as I wanted to feel as if I belonged, I just didn't. I couldn't. It's a feeling that entrenched itself into my psyche even as I grew and graduated and began a career. I overcompensated and hid behind a facade of being relentlessly optimistic and always ready to please, even though inside I was craving something, some intimacy that I couldn't articulate. The nice thing about having a career was that I was good at it. Always a strong academic performer, the idea of being able to throw myself into work and ignore the desperation of my social life was wonderful. And so it went on for many, many years. I did well for myself, and my occasional breakdowns were masked, dealt with and swept under the carpet as quickly and quietly as I could manage. I dealt with the symptoms and not the cause. By the end of 2015, it all came to a screeching halt. I messed up professionally. My relationship was in tatters, nothing new there, and everything I thought I knew about myself was in question. I spiralled downwards. Being in that place makes you numb. There's no up or down, there's no light, there's no value to you or anything around you. I once heard it described as if you had a swarm of flies buzzing around your head. You can't see, hear or feel anything other than those revolting little black beasties around you, and I think that's a good analogy. I was lucky. I picked up a phone and called for help. Mind, the mental health charity, were on the other side of that phone and they talked me down from the ledge. They gave me some tangible steps I could take right there and then that I hadn't even conceived of. A sliver of light appeared and I took a tiny but significant step. If there's one thing that I've learned through my recovery, it's this. Talk about it. Once I started to open up to my friends and family about what I was going through, it was like a dam broke. I wouldn't say it fixed everything, but showing myself in a vulnerable state and still receiving the love and support that I did made me realise that I didn't need to be superwoman. I didn't need to be perfect. People loved me, warts and all. Over the last 3 years, I've been able to realise a lifelong dream to sail across the world. Well, half of it, but still. On the Clipper Round the World yacht race. Through this, I've had an opportunity to raise money for Mind in Mid-Hearts and help them to continue the incredible work that they do to ensure everyone touched by mental ill health receives the respect and the support that they need. I've also been given opportunities to speak both publicly and in print about my experience and show people that just because you've suffered mental ill health doesn't mean you can't achieve something remarkable. Whatever remarkable means to you. Honestly, sometimes just getting out of bed should be heralded with a trophy and a roaring crowd. One of the Clipper catchphrases is that courage is contagious, and I truly, truly believe that. I hope that my story has given you the courage to stand up and proclaim, it's okay to say.
This is a comment piece from Jane Howdle with the headline, Why Won't We Answer the Door to Unexpected Visitors? We're a funny lot, us Brits, known globally for being socially awkward, queue enthusiasts. It turns out we can't even open our own front doors without getting ourselves all worked up. According to a new study, one in five Brits won't answer the door to anyone they're not expecting. When asked how often they might respond to unexpected guests, 46% of people quizzed by Hillarys.co.uk said they would only answer if it's someone I want to see, while 20% said they would never answer the door to anyone I'm not expecting. When asked who they would be most likely to avoid answering the door to, cold callers understandably came out on top with 87%, followed by neighbours at 65%. More interestingly, 25% are snubbing family members, 19% said they'd pretend not to hear their friends, while 16% admitted they'd ignore their partner. Reminds me of a family friend who used to lie on her living room floor when she saw her annoying neighbour coming up the drive. My neighbours are lovely, but there have been times I've wished for a solid wooden door with a sneaky peephole for when the dreaded Nottingham knockers rock up. We have a glass panel that makes it tricky to retreat to the living room floor when it's clear an unwelcome visitor is lurking outside. Unless you want them to see you wriggling away, that is. Interestingly, two-fifths of survey respondents also confessed to ignoring trick-or-treaters. I'm surprised it's not more. We fully embraced all things Halloween-related, taking our children out and loading up a bowl of e-numbers for our young visitors, and a lot of people seem to be out or hiding out at the back that night. I think that's fair enough. Halloween definitely isn't for everyone, and I admit I'd gone off it myself by 9 p.m, when some crazed banging and letterbox shaking started at my front door. I'd forgotten to turn the pumpkin lights off, but that didn't mean I was up for welcoming a gang of rowdy older kids after hours. But, being British, I waited until they'd moved on before quietly stepping out to turn out the lights.
Drivers with up to 30 penalty points escape bans. Dozens of unsafe drivers are still on the roads in St Albans despite racking up enough points for a ban. Analysis of DVLA data reveals that 65 drivers in the St Albans area have managed to dodge a ban after being given 12 or more penalty points on their licence, which is the usual threshold for losing the licence. Road safety charity Brake has slammed the current system, which it says is allowing repeat offenders to exploit loopholes in the law. It's accused the government and courts of being complicit in putting the public at risk. Currently, if a driver can convince the magistrates that they or an innocent party, such as a family member, will face exceptional hardship as a result of losing their licence, they may be permitted to keep it. The latest figures, which show penalty points as of July, show that there are almost 11,000 drivers across Great Britain who've retained their licences despite passing the points limit, some with more than 40 or 50 points. In St Albans, the highest number of points received by one driver who's still allowed to drive is 30. Around 23 in every 100,000 local drivers have at least 12 points on their licence, in line with the national average. The data's recorded by postcode district, so some drivers could live just across the border in neighbouring local authority areas. The country's worst serial offender is a 44-year-old man from Wolverhampton with 54 points. Joshua Harris, director of the Brakes Campaigns, said it's hugely concerning that so many offenders are being allowed to keep driving. He continued, by ignoring the exploitation of the exceptional hardship loophole that allows unsafe drivers to remain on our roads, the government and courts are complicit in increasing the risk to the public. This dangerous loophole must be dealt with as a matter of urgency so that drivers who reach 12 points are automatically disqualified, protecting the general public from harm. Driving is a privilege, not a right, and if that privilege is not exercised responsibly, it must be taken away. The charity is calling for the loophole to be closed as part of the Roads to Justice campaign, which says an urgent review should be carried out on the fundamentally flawed road traffic framework. Drivers can pick up penalty points, also known as endorsements, for a range of offences. Minor offences, such as speeding or failing to stop at a pedestrian crossing, might attract 3 points and will stay on your licence for 4 years unless it's wiped clean. Serious offences, such as drink or drug driving, could get you up to 11 points and these will stay on your licence for 11 years. If a driver gets 12 or more points in 3 years, they'll usually be banned from driving for 6 months. A Ministry of Justice spokesman said, "The vast majority of drivers who get 12 penalty points are automatically disqualified. The courts have access to DVLA records, which are taken into account, but sentencing is rightly a matter for independent judges based on the facts of each case." John Bash, chair of the Magistrates Association, added, "The process for establishing exceptional hardship is robust. Magistrates scrutinise every case very carefully, and an individual would only avoid a ban if the magistrates sitting in the case are confident that exceptional hardship would be genuinely caused."
This next piece is about tree planting in Harpenden. A tree has been planted in Harpenden as part of an event encouraging people to protect the environment and live sustainably. The silver birch tree, donated by Aylett Nurseries, was planted in Leighton Green by Town Mayor Councillor David Heritage. Originally, the tree formed part of an art installation at the Our Planet, Our Future event held at Rothamsted Research in April. Visitors at the event wrote pledges on parcel labels, which were hung on the three trees. Each of the trees are now being planted across the district. Sustainable St Albans trustee Leslie Flowers, who was part of the group organising the event, said, "We're delighted that the legacy from the Our Planet, Our Future event includes the planting of the three trees from the event's art installation. Videos of the inspiring talks are also available on our website." The project is continuing with a series of free evening events at the Harpenden Arms.
A St Albans homeless charity is looking for new trustees. Emmaus Hertfordshire provides a home and work for 39 people who have experienced homelessness and social exclusion, referred to as companions. Heritage consultant Rosie Fraser has been a trustee since 2013 and loves hearing about the companions' successes, whether that is moving into their own place, getting employed, passing their driving test, or completing a training course. She said, "These stories show me that Emmaus is doing important work. I would tell anyone interested in applying as a trustee to go for it. In return for using my skills and experience to support a local charity, I get the satisfaction of knowing that I have helped others and done something meaningful with my time. I also know that I'm acting as a role model for my two young children, and I hope it will encourage them to grow up wanting to help others. Trustees offer their skills, knowledge and experience to help in the development and governance of the charity. People from professional backgrounds, including planning, quantity surveying, building surveying, architects, structural engineers, ICT, health and social care, finance, communications, advertising, retail, direct marketing, fundraising and events management would be particularly welcome. The trustees meet as a board 6 times a year, and individual trustees may also get involved in other ways as their time permits. The charity provides full induction training and offers reimbursements for travel expenses. Companions are offered a supportive long-term home, as well as the opportunity to gain skills through working in the charity's 6 second-hand shops in St Albans, Hemel Hempstead, Tring, Harpenden, Hertford and Barnet. There's more information on this on the Emmaus website.
There's more coverage from the Armistice Centenary. The headline, "Descendant of World War I soldier marches at the cenotaph to remember family." A St Albans woman marched in the People's Procession on Remembrance Sunday to mark her family members who fought in World War I. 61-year-old Jo Woodworth of Townsend Drive marched past the cenotaph in London in honour of her grandfather and great-uncle, who fought in the First World War and her father, who fought in World War II. Her grandfather, Walter Eldridge, survived the war but lost a finger from a gunshot wound. Jo said, "He was born in London and that's where he lived, but he joined a Scottish regiment. His wife died in a flu epidemic 2 weeks after Armistice, so he came home to a baby, but no wife. He never talked about it, we just knew as grandchildren that Grandad had lost a finger. He met my grandmother and remarried and had four children, and they lived in the same house their whole life. Jo was also marching for her great-uncle Charles Tween, her grandmother's brother, who was killed at Ypres in 1915, and for her 94-year-old father, Peter Eldridge. She said, "Peter was 15 in 1939. He joined the RAF when he was 18 in 1942 and went off to Africa for training. He trained as a pilot and was all over Africa and the Middle East. I feel very proud. I don't want us to forget about World War I. We're going to mark this in a big way after 100 years, and then I think we should sort of put it to one side because we can't mark 101 years, 102 years, etc." At the parade, Jo marched alongside a cousin and carried a picture of her grandfather in his kilt. She said, "I don't think I had any concept of how many people 10,000 was. We did fill half a mile. There was a bit of waiting around, but we had big screens up so we could see what was going on. Everyone was swapping their family stories. I happened to be in the last column, so the main coverage had already finished by the time we started. I thought everyone would be gone, but there were still crowds of people waiting. It was really lovely. It was a fantastic atmosphere. I'd never been up to watch the parade before. Of course, we all did the 2 minute silence together. When you're with a crowd of people and people have their medals and wreaths, that was very emotional. When you're that close to the cenotaph, you realise what a big thing it is." And accompanying the story, there's a picture of the floral tributes around the cenotaph. There's a big picture of Jo Woodworth with a wreath of poppies with a thank you card in the middle of it. There's also some old photographs from the family heirlooms, a great uncle Charles Tween, who was killed in Ypres looking smart in his uniform, her grandfather Walter Eldridge in his Scottish fearsome looking fighting outfit, including a kilt, and her father Peter Eldridge in his RAF outfit.
An article now about a local man finding fame. Actor is having a marvellous time with Hollywood career. A Hollywood actor who grew up in St Albans is starring in Marvel's latest superhero TV series on Netflix. Jay Ali, 37, left St Albans 9 years ago to pursue his dream of becoming an actor and now plays FBI agent Ray Nadim on the third season of Daredevil. In the show, which follows blind superhero Matt Murdock as he fights crime in New York, Jay's character becomes unknowingly involved with villainous businessman Wilson Fisk. Jay grew up in St John's Court and attended Fleetfield Junior School and Verulam School. Now living in LA, he told the Hearts ad how he became an actor. "While living in St Albans, there's not much opportunity to go and do acting," he said. "I played a lot of cricket and so I thought I was going to be a cricket player. I just packed up a bag and moved to LA 9 years ago. Everyone was like, 'We'll see you in a couple of weeks.' I started auditioning and getting work and I've been very, very lucky." Despite his success, Jay was homeless for 5 years whilst he worked towards taking on bigger roles. He said, "My first acting job was on the reboot of Melrose Place. I thought it was my big break. It was tough and I struggled. I was homeless and I used to get a foot-long Subway sandwich and that was my breakfast, lunch and dinner." Jay ended up getting a recurring role in a family drama, The Fosters, which he said opened up a lot of doors for him. He travelled to New York and auditioned for Marvel, not knowing which show he was auditioning for due to the secrecy surrounding the process. Jay said, "It was all amazing. Being in such a huge show, which is for Marvel and Netflix, is unbelievable. I didn't know the character was going to be so integral to the story when I got the role. I've been very fortunate that the character's being called the breakout star of the show. It's the role of a lifetime for sure." Jay still returns to St Albans every couple of months to see his family. He said, "It's only when you move away that you realise just how amazing St Albans is. It's magical to have that amount of greenery and history." For his next project, Jay will be appearing in a film with Suraj Sharma, who starred in The Life of Pi. Daredevil Season 3 was released on Netflix on October the 19th.
A Harpenden Barbershop Harmony Group will be performing at a Christmas carol concert to raise money for charity. TV presenter Pam Rhodes, who presents BBC's Songs of Praise, will host Rennie Grove Hospice's annual carol concert on Thursday, December the 6th at St Peter's Church. The concert will feature a performance from the King of Hearts, who are a Harpenden-based barbershop harmony group, as well as the Amici Singers, who will be read by Battle of the Proms conductor Douglas Coombs. To book tickets, call Gemma on 01727 731 018.
Here's another concert that you might be interested in. The Carillon Chamber Choir will perform in Harpenden next weekend. David Eyerson will conduct the chamber choir in a programme entitled The English Revival on Saturday, November the 24th in St John's Church. David said, "This is the best of English choral music throughout the centuries, moving through Bird and Gibbons of the first Elizabethan age to Stanford and Vaughan Williams, especially featuring his glorious Mass in G minor." The young clarinetist from South Bank Symphonia, Greg Hurl, will play the joyful Bagatelles by Finzi, as well as Brief Candles, which shows the clarinet to be an amazingly versatile and expressive instrument. There's more information on Carillon's website. You might also be interested in some more contemporary concerts offered by the Alban Arena. This Saturday, November the 17th, there is the Maximum Rhythm and Blues with the Manfreds concert, and the Matt Munro story comes on Tuesday the 20th of November. Finally, nearer Christmas, we've got the Big Band concert at Christmas on Wednesday the 21st of November.
Here are some details of some other musical events upcoming. An acclaimed American drummer will be performing at Hearts Jazz next week. The Jeff Williams Band plays Hearts Jazz at the Maltings Arts Theatre in St Albans on Tuesday, November the 20th. Across a career spanning four decades, it would seem easiest to consider the musicians with whom Jeff Williams hasn't worked. A respected stalwart of the international jazz circuit, the American drummer has most notably accompanied Stan Getz, Dizzy Gillespie, Lee Konitz, Dave Liebman, Randy Brecker, John Abercrombie and Joe Lovano. Since making a second home in London, Jeff has performed in the UK with Kenny Wheeler, Norma Winston, and has toured with Bill McHenry, the Phil Robinson-Dave Liebman Quartet, and many others. Advance tickets for this gig cost £11 for members, £12 for concessions, and full-price tickets cost £13. A piano quartet will perform the lunchtime music in a St Albans church next week. There will be a recital by the Chagall Piano Quartet at St Peter's Church on Wednesday, November the 21st. Quartet members Katarzyna Zeminska, who plays the violin, viola player Emily Hester and cellist Alice Purton and Ian Tyndall on piano are an exciting young chamber group based in London, dedicated to exploring the rich and varied repertoire available for this instrumentation. Praised for their imaginative and demanding programmes, they combine well-known works with rarely performed gems. Their performance for St. Peter's will include Mozart's Piano Quartet No. 2 in E-flat major, the Piano Quartet No. 1 in C minor, Opus 15, by Gabriel Fauré. The music starts at 1 p.m. Entry is free, with donations in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care. Following next Wednesday's recital, pianist Lynn Arnold will be performing at the church on November the 28th.
News of another concert in St Albans. St Albans Bach Choir will be commemorating the centenary of the Armistice with a concert at the city's cathedral this weekend. For its concert at St Albans Cathedral on Saturday, November the 17th, the choir's put together a programme reflecting on war and peace, drawing on the best of English music. Choir members have coupled moving and deeply felt choral works by two of the greatest English composers, Elgar and Vaughan Williams, with a lyrical rhapsody by Vaughan Williams' friend Butterworth, whose list of compositions is tragically short. He was killed in action in the Somme in 1916. Conductor Andrew Lucas said, "The Spirit of England was composed by Elgar between 1915 and 1917. Setting some of Lawrence Binyon's poems dating from 1914, it is evocative choral music written in the Great War, setting lines including "They shall not grow old" that have become immortalised in annual services of remembrance. The music is vintage Elgar and deserves to be better known. St Albans Cathedral's Master of Music added, "Paired with this, our other choral work, Vaughan Williams' Dona Nobis Pacem, dates from the period immediately before the World War II. In this heartfelt appeal for peace in a very troubled time, the composer, who knew the horrors of war, having volunteered at aged 42 and served in World War I, was inspired to produce some of his most effective and haunting choral and orchestral music. Between these two items, we'll hear Butterworth's gorgeous rhapsody for the orchestra, A Shropshire Lad. Sublime music from 1911, by a composer who went to war but never returned, like Hausmann's Lads That Will Die in Their Glory and Never Be Old, from the poems that inspired the work. The choirs joined as soloists by rising stars Gemma Summerfield, soprano, and Louis Hurst, baritone, and orchestra Sinfonia Verdi. The evening promised to offer a fitting reflection on the tragedy of war and the hope of peace at this special time of remembrance. Doors open at 7 p.m. and the concert begins at 7:30 p.m. Tickets cost from £13 to £30. Book online or by phone or in person at the Cathedral box office. Telephone 01727 890 290.
A look now at radio programmes broadcast in the week ahead.
For Saturday the 17th of November, Opera on Three on Radio 3 at 5 p.m. is the third instalment of Wagner's Ring Cycle, for which listeners have had to wait 2 weeks. This episode is Siegfried and is performed by members of the Royal Opera and the Royal Opera House Orchestra, conducted by Antonio Papano. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4, Archive on 4 presents The Black Footballer's Dilemma. Footballer Clark Carlisle looks back at the challenges black players faced at a time when racist abuse from the terraces and insults in the dressing room were a regular occurrence. He talks to other former players and how they dealt with the dilemma of concentrating on the job and excelling on the pitch or using their position to speak out. Also on Radio 4 at 9:45 p.m. is Niche Work If You Can Get It. In this edition, Life Story Writers, Nick Baker meets people doing niche jobs, focusing on ghostwriters who are working not with celebrities, but with ordinary people telling their stories for posterity. For Sunday the 18th of November, The Michael Ball Show on Radio 2 at 11 a.m. is live from the Savoy Theatre in London as part of the Children in Need campaign. He hosts guest stars including Sir Tom Jones, Sheridan Smith, Boyzone, The Kingdom Choir and Alfie Bow, and adds his own velvety vocals for a musical treat. On Radio 4 at 11:15 a.m. in Desert Island Discs, Lauren Laverne is joined by Cressida Dick, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. This programme is repeated at 9 o'clock on Friday morning. Then at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3, Drama on 3 is The Cherry Orchard. This is a new version of Chekhov's celebrated stage play adapted for radio and written by Catherine Tozer with sound and music by John Chambers.
And now a look at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. Book of the Week on Radio 4 FM at 9:45 is Becoming. Former First Lady Michelle Obama reads from her closely guarded memoirs, which were released this week. She describes with unerring honesty her life experiences from university onwards, her triumphs and her disappointments, both private and public. The 15-minute drama on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. and 7:45 p.m. is Incredible Women. This comedy is written by Jeremy Front and stars his sister, actress Rebecca Front, playing Jessica Kennedy, whom Jeremy has to interview for a programme he is making as she is expected to be the next Director General of the BBC. The interview does not produce the answers he is expecting. At midday on Radio 3, Composer of the Week explores the life and work of American jazz musician Billy Strayhorn. He worked with Duke Ellington and his orchestra for 25 years before achieving solo status. Jonathan Coe's new novel, Middle England, is serialised on Radio 4 in 10 episodes at 12:04 p.m. and as the book at bedtime at 10:45 p.m. Actor Jeff Rawle reads this abridged version, which spans 8 years and tries to make sense of Brexit Britain, following a group of people through a time of change. From Tuesday onwards on Radio 3 at 1 p.m, the lunchtime concert presents four programmes of highlights from this year's Dartington Summer School and Festival.
And here are some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday the 19th of November at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 in Start the Week, Amal Rajan is joined by guests to discuss free speech and the epidemic of anxiety among young people. Jack D hosts I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 from Poole in Dorset. He's joined by panel members Tim Brooke-Taylor, Barry Cryer, Tony Hawkes and John Finnemore. The Full Works concert on Classic FM at 8 p.m. showcases composers who've travelled far and wide. Jane Jones presents music by Rossini, Wagner, Dvorak, Elgar and Hummel. On Tuesday the 20th of November at 9:30 a.m. in 1 to 1 on Radio 4, Lynn Truss, who hates travelling and is curious as to why we do it at all, talks to Gillian Murphy about her experiences and the reality of travelling across the world in a camper van with her husband and three young daughters. Actor John Nettles is also a keen historian and resident of North Devon, has written and narrates this highly recommended drama documentary on the life of Sir Walter Raleigh. It's a tale of love, lust, piracy and torture. This is the first of two episodes on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and it's repeated at 3 p.m. On the BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m. and 11:05 p.m, the documentary is part of the BBC's 100 Women season. BBC South America correspondent Katie Watson speaks to some of the activists fighting for women's rights in Argentina. At 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4 in Front Row, actor Kurt Russell talks about his life and career. And on Radio 2 at 10 p.m, Bruno Tonioli, Strictly Come Dancing judge and choreographer, continues to share his love of opera.
On Wednesday the 21st of November, Radio 4 begins a series at 9:30 a.m. of The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry. This episode discovers how ancestry DNA works and what they can reveal about our heritage, and also a trip through Norse history. In The Full Works concert on Classic FM at 8 p.m, Jane Jones presents a selection of pieces which originally received terrible reviews, but survived to become successful favourites. On Radio 2 at 9 p.m, film and West End producer Bill Kenwright returns to present a new series of Golden Years with radio oldies from rock and roll from the 1950s to the early 1960s Beatles sound. On Thursday the 22nd of November, Radio 4 begins a new series, Crossing Continents, at 11 a.m, with the first episode exploring the state of Nigeria's health services, where only 5% have health insurance and, for others, all care has to be paid for. Examples of the nightmares experienced include a new mother who couldn't pay for her treatment and had to wait in the hospital for 16 months until human rights lawyers and police arrived to release her. At 7:30 p.m. on Radio 2, continuing their In Concert season, Joe Wiley introduces Emily Sandé at the BBC Radio Theatre, performing many of her hits and material from her latest album. On Friday the 23rd of November, at 8 p.m. on Radio 2, Friday Night is Music Night. Hosted tonight by Ed Balls, former Shadow Chancellor, Strictly star and Norwich Football Club chairman, who indulges his love of musicals in this concert recorded in September at the Hackney Empire. The music is from some of the most iconic shows and including current stage hits.
We continue with today's bereavement notices.
Here are the names of people and then ages, if published, who've died recently and whose names are recorded in the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Peter William Baines, aged 76. Nellie Colfer, aged 86. Pauline Burgess, aged 79. And finally, Ronald Jeram.
Think I left my sweetheart standing there. Think I left my sweetheart standing there. Think I left my sweetheart. She was standing with a ribbon in her hair.
Hello, I'm David, and here's an article from Hertfordshire Life magazine of November 2018 called Hertfordshire's Great War. In it, we mark the centenary of the First World War armistice with an account of its impact on the county many would not see again. The words are by Stephen Roberts. The guns fell silent at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. It was November 1918, and the First World War was finally over. After more than 4 years of horror and attrition, what did the conflict and its end mean to the county of Hertfordshire? You begin to comprehend the carnage of the war when you learn of just one thankful village in Hertfordshire. These were the fortunate and rare communities who lost no servicemen, when all around them did. Puttenham, in the county's northwest, had all its soldiers return home. Every other community in Hertfordshire, from city and town to village and hamlet, lost loved ones. There was a strong mood after the war, of course, to honour the fallen. Virtually every one of Hertfordshire's 130-odd parishes has a memorial dedicated to its dead in the war to end all wars. Sadly, with other names added all too soon from the Second World War. Many of the county's men who served abroad fought with the Hertfordshire Regiment, a pre-war territorial force unit of part-time soldiers, one of a small number of such units called upon to support the regular army as the British Expeditionary Force battled the Germans in August 1914. As such, the Hertfordshire Regiment's war would be a roll call of the British Army's major Western Front engagements. The Hearts lads, ordinary fellows from all walks of life, earned the respect of the regular army, being dubbed the Hearts Guards in the process. The 1st Battalion of the Hertfordshire Regiment was the only one of its battalions to serve abroad, arriving in France in November 1914 and joining the closing stages of the First Battle of Ypres. The following year, the men fought at Loos, the major British offensive of 1915, and then at the grinding Battle of the Somme in 1916, when it achieved a notable but toll-taking success in the offensive's final stage, the Battle of Ancre, advancing 1,600 yards and taking 250 prisoners, the battalion's casualties numbering 7 officers and 150 men. The Third Battle of Ypres, Passchendaele, commencing in July 1917, saw the battalion suffer grievously at the hands of enemy machine guns. On the last day of the month alone, all the battalion's officers were casualties, including 11 dead plus 459 other ranks. The final year of the war saw the 1st Battalion thrown into the front line again to help withstand the German spring offensive, its last desperate attempt to prevail on the Western Front in March 1918. As the war finally turned in the Allies' favour, the battalion would be involved in the fighting for the German Hindenburg Line. Almost 900 men of all ranks from the battalion fell in action during the war, with 2,000 more wounded or taken prisoner. Nearly 200 gallantry medals were awarded, two of which were Victoria Crosses. Corporal Alfred Burt, a Hertford-born gas fitter, was 20 when he won the VC for disabling a German bomb that fell in his trench at the Battle of Loos. Second Lieutenant Frank Young was posthumously awarded the Army's highest honour in September 1918 for courageous leadership, enabling the battalion to hold a position in the face of fierce enemy assault. He was just 22. Many other Hertfordshire men served in the regular army ranks of the Bedfordshire Regiment. Private Christopher Cox, a farm labourer, was born in King's Langley and was one of the Hearts lads to join the neighbouring regiment. He won the VC in March 1917 for single-handedly bringing in 4 wounded comrades from enemy machine gun fire-swept ground. Private Edward Barber of Tring was posthumously awarded the VC in March 1915 for valiantly attacking large numbers of the enemy with grenades, resulting in his own death, aged 21. He was a Grenadier Guardsman. With the huge numbers of wounded, the need for hospitals at home increased as the war progressed. Hertfordshire ended up with around 40 auxiliary hospitals, everything from church halls, such as St James's Hall and Ewan Hall in Barnet, a golf club in Nebworth, a school in Royston, and mansions such as St Paul's Waldenbury, near Hitchin, childhood home of the Queen Mother. The war was not just fought on foreign fields, but on these shores too, as German airships brought the conflict to the skies over Hertfordshire. Principally aiming for London, they dropped bombs on Essendon, Cheshunt, Willian and Hartford, destroying buildings and injuring and killing residents. One of these Zeppelin was shot down by a Home Guard squadron biplane at Cuffley in September 1916. Another, lit up by the Barnett searchlight detachment, was destroyed the following month. The crew of both airships were killed. The First World War was the first total war in which a whole nation was mobilised in a fight to the finish. If you weren't serving at the front, you might be working the land, helping to feed a nation threatened with starvation due to Germany's deadly U-boat blockade of ships, or working in munitions factories as Britain made the shells used to pound the German army into submission. There was a munitions factory in Dunham's Lane in Letchworth called Crin and Ley. Founded by refugees, it employed many Belgian refugees. It had ostensibly been Germany's invasion of Belgium that brought Britain into the war in August 1914. By the end of the war, Belgians made up a quarter of the Garden City's population. They were welcomed by residents, concerts were put on, and efforts were made to speak and label things in French. But the numbers put pressure on housing, finally leading to the creation of the Westbury area, dubbed Little Antwerp. As with many factories, John Dickinson's historic paper mill at Apsley was also converted to munitions production. The shortage of manpower was acutely felt, to the extent it was jested that milk deliveries might be reduced to sending a cow round door to door so householders could help themselves. But when you hear what happened at Heath Farm Dairy in St Albans, which supplied around 2,500 customers, you realise the joke had a sharp edge. When war broke out, the business had 12 milkmen. By May 1916, this had reduced to 5, conscription having been introduced by then. And when a further 3 were called up, the owner, Jacob Reynolds, made strenuous efforts to hold on to his men at St Albans Tribunal, but got nowhere, other than in September 1916, when he was permitted to retain his son-in-law, Arthur Martin, so long as he joined the Volunteer Training Corps, the equivalent of the Home Guard. Another small business which suffered a labour shortage was that of watercress grower Thomas Partridge, who had beds near Rickmansworth. The crop became a staple during the conflict. He was repeatedly hauled before St Albans Tribunal as he pleaded exemption from conscription on the grounds of hardship, claiming his removal would ruin his business and those dependent on him. Prior to the war, he employed around 10 men, but by February 1917, his depleted resources were just 3 older men. Stepping into the roles of men in many professions, however, were the women of Hertfordshire, who played a crucial role on the home front. They became land girls in the Women's Land Army, reclaiming land, growing crops and farming animals across the county, as well as munitions factory workers. In some factories in Britain, more than 90% were women, as well as many other jobs. The social shift this represented was to play an important role in the fight for women's suffrage. With the need for food pressing, more and more allotments were created as Hart's folk dug for victory. In St Albans, there was the additional pressure on resources due to some 7,000 trainee soldiers billeted in what had become a garrison town, many of whom were occupying spare rooms in homes. The extra burden on residents was considerable. But the vicar of St Peter's, while recognising how pressed his parishioners were, urged them not to forget their duty to God and attend church. The people of St Albans helped in other ways too. By the end of 1919, they had raised nearly £900,000 in war savings. Some of this came from the wealthy, but also from savings by ordinary workers. This month, the county's war memorials will again be the focus for remembrance, with added poignancy as we recall the end of a shattering conflict that finally ground to a halt a century ago after levels of death and destruction that would inhabit people's worst nightmares for years and often lifetimes. Some may ponder why we bother remembering a war from so long ago. The 1914-1918 names on all the memorials in the county provide the justification. Close to 900 men of the Hertfordshire Regiment alone never walked back into their homes and into the arms of their loved ones. Lest we forget.
Hello, I'm Sue, and this article is from the November 2018 edition of the Hertfordshire Life magazine, and it's called The Half-Shilling Curate. From Hartford to Flanders, a young army chaplain kept a vivid record of his experiences in the First World War. Sarah Ray tells her grandfather's remarkable story. Reverend Herbert Cowell is the only known army chaplain to be awarded the Military Cross for exemplary gallantry on a ship during the Great War. Herbert was born in 1886, the son of a Wesleyan minister. In 1904, the Cowell family lived on Ware Road in Hartford, and Herbert was head boy at Hartford Grammar School. In that peaceful time, little did the family know that in 10 years' time, the country would be at war, and Herbert would be one of the first to volunteer as a chaplain to the troops. In the summer of 1914, Herbert was ordained into the Wesleyan Church. Less than a week later, Britain declared war on Germany. With patriotism and faith inextricably linked, churches responded to the army's call with a supply of candidates for chaplaincy posts to provide spiritual guidance to soldiers and be involved in all aspects of their welfare. Suitability depended on physical fitness, an ability to preach extempore, horsemanship, and a good knowledge of French. Herbert had all these qualities, and in his 20s was one of the youngest Wesleyan army chaplains, giving him an advantage in terms of being able to relate to the young soldiers. Herbert's journey would take him to the army home camp in Aldershot and on to France and Flanders on the Western Front. Attached to the 68th Brigade of the 23rd Division British Expeditionary Force, it was not long before Herbert realised the reality of service at the battlefront. He wrote home to his parents. "Sometimes, as I cross a bit of rising ground between here and headquarters, where the country is open and the road only lined by an endless avenue of huge, polled witch elms, I stand in the darkness, watching the probing searchlights flicker onto the clouds and hear those grim, far-off voices speaking death. It is a new sound, it is another world, and it calls to unprecedented scenes and experiences. God grant, as we march into it all, that there may arise a man in me that is sufficient to this new occasion." He humbly signed his letters home, "From your loving son, the half-shilling curate, Herbert." Serving amidst the mud, mayhem and misery of the front, Herbert befriended soldiers, held Sunday service, buried the dead and comforted the wounded. He remembered the circumstances of his first burial. A sergeant killed in no man's land by the all too familiar story, a star shell, a volley, and his companion was more fortunate than he. "I wish you could see that little burial place, an old village orchard, in whose trees the birds sang morning and evening as if by choice. There were a few flowers in the grass, and long trails of crimson creeper hung from the cottage walls on two sides. Even while the firing party took their places by the graveside, two great shells came screaming into the adjoining garden and burst with an angry crash. The men must lie down under the nearest wall, and even as I stood there reading the service, every British gun in the fields behind chose the time to talk back to the German gunners. Yet, for all the hellish din of the moments, the peace of that laying by seemed unbroken, and when his comrades had gathered from the shattered gardens around a handful of flowers and placed them on the upturned soil, one felt that there was something triumphant about the passing of the sergeant. 3 months into Herbert's service, he was himself severely wounded during a heavy enemy bombardment as shrapnel sliced through the side of his head, jaw, and throat. He vividly remembered the bombardment as they tried to take shelter. 100 yards away, a shell threw a huge column of stone and soil into the air. I tried to answer the doctor's exclamation that they were getting nearer, when I was aware of an intolerable pressure on my right jaw. I would step into that open doorway to be out of the way of falling stones. But why, having done so, was I plunged head foremost onto a stone floor thick with mud and dabbled with red? For a moment I lay there gazing through the glassless window. The sky was a hazy blue, and white, watery clouds were heralding more rain. That meant more mud, and the cellar in which we slept would be green with mist when we turned in tonight. Then the doctor came and knelt at my side, and I remember the disgust with which I realised, as he asked me to lie still, that I was kicking furiously. Outside, a voice called, "Bring a stretcher, the chaplain's hit," and another, "Well, I reckon he's done." Herbert was operated on and miraculously survived the surgery and blood loss. There were no transfusions at the front. Unable to walk or talk, he was ordered back to England to recuperate and placed on a cot bed aboard the hospital ship Anglia. Fully laden and with more than 400 wounded and 6 servicemen from the battlefront, she hit a German mine in the Channel. Lying close to the point of impact, the back of Herbert's head was cut open from ear to ear. He later described the scene and the calamitous events as the ship began to fill with water and lurched to the bottom of the sea. Crushed thus, choking with salt water and stunned by the new wound in the head, I was carried some 20 feet down the passage. It was then that, as I like to think, the angel of God became my deliverer. For I found myself suddenly and unaccountably standing on my feet in the midst of the water and the wreckage. A few hours before, I could not walk, but now I walked along the passage. Once he was on deck, and despite his own terrible injuries, Herbert helped to save many lives by getting rafts into the water. These were picked up by ships diverted to the scene. He was awarded the Military Cross in recognition of his superhuman efforts. Back in England, his second battle was recovery, helped by his devoted sister Muriel. And although he was never fit enough to return to overseas duties, he took up work as a chaplain in the army garrisons and home camps. Towards the end of the war, he described a scene of men who had returned to one of the camps from the battlefront. One evening, I entered that room for some weeknight meeting, and there, covering the floor and propped up against the walls, packed from end to end, side to side, were wounded men just unloaded from the Western Front. They were the heroes of the hour, and very well they knew it. But for all their pathetic disfigurements and their ghastly wounds, they were the gayest company I remember meeting. 20 years later, Herbert found himself in the centre of another war. His family were evacuated from London, but he stayed through the Blitz, driven by his faith to serve. Like so many, Herbert never later spoke about the First World War, but while literally unable to speak for many months due to his injuries, he did write copious notes, which I discovered at the family home along with his letters. As I began this journey discovering my grandfather's story, I became drawn to the much under-recognised role of the army chaplains during the Great War. Their importance was not lost at the time. As Field Marshal Douglas Haig wrote, "A good chaplain is as valuable as a good general."
Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown. I think I left some friends along the way.
One 100 years ago, between July and November 1917, the fields of Flanders witnessed one of the bloodiest episodes of the First World War. What took place was officially known as the Third Battle of Ypres, but history recalls the horror as Passchendaele. The chief of the General Staff, Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig's main aim in initiating the battle was to break through to the coast of Belgium, so that the German submarine pens could be destroyed. The Allied assault was launched in the early hours of the 31st of July 1917. Because of the torrential rain, the British and Canadian troops found themselves fighting not only the Germans, but a quagmire of stinking mud that swallowed up men, horses and tanks. After 3 months, 1 week and 3 days of brutal trench warfare, the Allies finally recaptured the village of Passchendaele. But by then, around 250,000 British and Allied soldiers had been killed or wounded in some of the most horrific trench warfare of the conflict. Many of the Hertfordshire men on the fighting front served with the Hertfordshire Regiment. As a pre-war territorial unit, the men of the Harts were part-time soldiers coming from all walks of life.
The Hertfordshire Yeomanry received telegrams at 3 a.m. on the 5th of August, ordering them to report immediately. The Munden troop appeared in their mucking out clothes and little kit, while 2nd Lieutenant Thurston Holland Hibbert dashed to the Army and Navy stores in London, only to find that they had sold out of revolvers. He found one, however, at the Ironmongers in Watford and a room at the Clarendon Hotel.
The 1st Battalion Hertfordshire Regiment were the only infantry unit from the county to see service overseas, serving on the Western Front from November 1914. But at Passchendaele, the Hertfordshire Regiment's 620 men and officers were virtually wiped out in the first 2 hours of fighting on July the 31st, 1917. They attacked near the village of Saint-Julien, and all the regiment's officers and 75% of the other ranks were either killed, wounded, or captured. To mark the centenary, the Hearts at War Community History Project has unveiled a monument to the Hertfordshire Regiment at the battlefield. Hertfordshire's then Lord Lieutenant, Lady Verulam, was there, and so too was Howard Gard, a deputy lieutenant and the author and director of a film called A County at War, which was made in 2014 to mark Hertfordshire's contribution to the First World War effort. And Howard joins me now. So Howard, we'll talk about the film a wee bit later on, but can you just describe for us what the ceremony was like when you arrived in Flanders? Did you go to Saint-Julien itself?
We did. There was a surprisingly large number of people on a battlefield tour. They weren't all from Hertfordshire, but there was a minibus from Sawbridgeworth, quite a few people from Letchworth. And they had really come with the Hearts of War project. It was a field of long grass with two roads dissecting it. And at the junction, there was this very small but pugnacious monument covered in a Union Jack. Not very tall, because unfortunately the Belgian authorities, the planning regulations were such that it had to be not too high. But it was, when unveiled, it was in black marble, and it had an account of very much as you have just read, but it also had a plan of the battlefield area. And we then went on a guided walk around the battlefield. We started where the men had arrived. They moved up to the front at 3:30 in the morning, but they didn't actually get to the front line. They didn't get to no man's land until about 8:30. And there's a river, a very small river, but with very steep banks that they had to cross. And one of their tanks fell in and the other one had broken down on the way. So they arrived at the battlefield without the support of tanks. They nonetheless pressed on. It was a very shallow hillside. You couldn't really call it a hill, as much of Flanders is very flat, but of course it gave the Germans an incredibly strong vantage point because our men were for the entire time coming uphill. And the German line, there were no trenches. It was not like the Somme. It was not like what you expect. It was that our men had come from a staging area in the rear. They were protected by artillery, but the Germans were protected by bunkers, and they had a whole series of strong points all the way across the skyline, which were coincidentally protecting a windmill. The windmill was not exactly a military objective, but it was, in fact, the objective of this attack, that our men would take the windmill, which is there still today, and it was grinding corn, and it was particularly moving to think there are photographs of it on its side having been blown up, but like the whole of Belgium, it was rebuilt after the First World War.
There were tanks to help the Hertfordshires in July 1917 at the battle that we now call Passchendaele. But the mud stopped them before they could support the advance on Saint-Julien. It had rained continuously for 2 days, and the ground was impassable. In 2 hours, the regiment lost 479 men, killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. They came from every corner of Hertfordshire. The commanding officer, Colonel Frank Page, was from Hertford and died at the start of the advance. All of his young officers also died. The few men left retreated under the command of the regiment's padre. A quartermaster arrived shortly after the battle with supplies and asked a staff officer where he could find the Hertfordshires. After a long pause, the officer replied, "There is no Hertfordshire regiment."
I had, I think, like many people, assumed that I would at least feel where the trenches had been. And, of course, they've been totally obliterated. The entire area had been very, very heavily shelled, so it was full of craters. Not as big as you might imagine, but a multitude of them. But we went to a farm museum because they have something called the metal harvest, because the unexploded munitions and bits of tanks and field guns and the whole debris of the war, which is a few feet underground, does actually start to work its way to the surface. And so they're constantly ploughing up mainly unexploded shells, but an enormous variety every year. And we went to see this museum, and they explained that the government granted farmers money to fill all the shell holes in 1918, 1919, and that the horses would go round and round and round in circles around a crater, turning the earth into it, because, of course, there were no mechanical diggers, there were no bulldozers, it was just horses and men. And it took them years to get rid of the craters, but, of course, they are now obliterated. So it was difficult to come to terms with the fact that there was nothing tangible there. But certainly you got the sense that if you stripped out all the trees that we were looking at, took out all the endless green, because it's very verdant, and superimposed brown earth and holes and machine gun bullets, you definitely started to feel that it was an absolutely unforgiving slope to walk up if you were under fire. And I think that's what came through, because the casualties were enormously high. And all the time, the windmill was sitting there going round, painted very pretty colours, clearly working very well, and you were left wondering what on earth it had been for, because it was not exactly a military objective. And I think one is used to expecting, or one expects, military objectives to be in some way tangible. And I think that's true of the whole of the Passchendaele, the Ypres front, because it was all for nothing, over nothing, which is very hard to understand rationally.
You spent nearly 3 days on the trip. Did you feel quite immersed in sort of history at the time?
Belgium is steeped in the First World War. I think the first thing you notice are the little Belgian villages, which were all destroyed and were entirely rebuilt exactly as they were. So it's not that you're looking at a museum, but you can't quite understand why these not very fit-for-purpose houses now, in our current thinking, are looking so pristine and well, because, of course, they rebuilt everything as it was. So every town, every village is almost locked in time. There are the inevitable. In Ypres, in the square, there are shops like Tommy's Souvenirs, and obviously now it's actually big business for battlefield tours and tourists in general. But the villages just live with it. They're not exploiting it. It's there. The cemeteries, there are 147 cemeteries, Commonwealth War Graves Commission, in the Passchendaele salient, which is a very small area, and they follow the line of the front line. And they're at every corner, in every field. And the vast majority of them are in fields. Some, very worryingly, are right in the middle of towns, because, of course, the towns were shelled flat and then rebuilt. But the cemeteries are the only abiding thing from the war. Now, that is a very powerful image. And you get them at the bend in rivers, and you get them lots by roads. huge number in fields, and surprisingly small, 100 men, 80 men, some of them really very small, because the dead were buried where they fell. And while the numbers are absolutely astonishing, 500,000 men are estimated to have died, because the Germans also lost a huge number of men. There are only a few colossal graveyards, and they were very much, they're called concentration graveyards, because bodies came from a much wider area. But for the most part, they're quite small, but there are an awful lot of them. So it's completely inescapable.
I think one of the battlefield guides who you were talking to during the course of your visit particularly mentioned Hertfordshire, didn't he? And the sort of legacy that the sacrifice Hertfordshire Regiment made.
He works for a company called Battlefield Tours, and he very dramatically, it was not quite Shakespeare, but he very dramatically knelt down and scooped up a handful of rather sandy soil and let it run through his fingers. And he said, "I encourage everybody from Hertfordshire that comes here to do this, because it's got your DNA, because the Hertfordshire Regiment died in this field." And that was a very powerful image.
For you, this must have been following the film that you made in 2014 commemorate the Hertfordshire war effort. To add this at the end of that must have been quite something. Let's turn to the film that you made. I mean, the research was absolutely fascinating, because the film itself doesn't have a lot of moving images, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you gathered from personal archives as well as the county archives. Where did you get the material?
I should explain it. It started with a request from the Queen that every county did something to mark the start of the First World War. And that request went out to the Lord Lieutenants. So Lady Verulam gathered a small group of people, and we discussed initially doing an exhibition. It was going to be at the High Sheriff's garden party, so there'd be a lot of talking and a lot of socialising, and there would have been a huge effort to create the exhibition, and there was a real danger that it would not be seen in the best possible circumstances. And if we tried to make a touring exhibition, that was extremely difficult, because they have to be fairly robust, expensive to produce, and also difficult to put on, because they're very demanding of space, and particularly if it was going to go to schools, it was unlikely to go to many. So we settled on making a film, which of course had the huge advantage that the DVD is very cheap to produce. The initial order was for 2,000, and it went to every school in Hertfordshire and all the museums, and people bought copies for a £5 donation. We didn't sell the film, we just asked for a donation to the Army Benevolent Fund. And people organised it in village halls and had little screenings, which was extremely gratifying. I went to a museum in Sawbridgeworth, and they estimated that they had shown it to 2,000 people, which is tremendous exposure. So we embarked on a film, and I assumed that we would end up with a lot of Imperial War Museum footage, and that we would supplement it with photographs from local museums in Hertfordshire. I was always aware that this is a very well-trodden path, and that all the material we would be using is generic. It was really quite difficult to tailor it to Hertfordshire and to make it unique in a way that we had not seen before on television. And I quickly came to question the film footage that we were seeing, because we've seen it all before, and it's also tends to be a bit too jolly and a bit too artificial. We had a small budget, and we hired Dan Hill, who was also involved with the Hearts of War project. And Dan did all the initial research for me, mainly from county archives. And I quickly appreciated that the photographs were really original and very distinctive, and told a powerful story, much more so than the film archive. Plus the fact the film archive was very expensive to use, because we had to pay royalties and the still photographs weren't.
What you did pull out was the personal photographs of families who have lived for generations in Hertfordshire.
We did. A man right at the end came with a photograph of his mother, who was called Winnie, and she was 17 when the photograph was taken in 1917, and she worked in a munitions factory. And that was just magic. Magic for me. He was not well. He was in his 80s. He didn't come to our screening. We never met him. he sent his contribution in through his local museum. But that was just two people that spanned that 100 years, which was, I thought, quite remarkable.
Stand for a moment on our village greens or in our market squares, and you can still hear the voices of the men who did not come home, the men who stayed forever in a foreign land.
When you go home, tell them of us and say, for their tomorrow, we gave our today.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks, as ever, to all our contributors, including our readers, Margaret, Hilary, Dominic and Sarah. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme. But that's all from me, Bill Redway, in November 2018. We close with Dan Rouser's song, Rivertown. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.
Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown, I think I left some friends along the way. Think I left my sweetheart standing there. Think I left my sweetheart standing there. Think I left my sweetheart, she was standing with a ribbon. For Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown today. Going back for Rivertown. I think I left some friends along the way. Ashes from the floor. Help me sweep the ashes from the floor. Help me sweep the ashes. Help me see the way I did before. I won't try to wake you, I will not try to drag you.